trouble is, when you start looking at an individual like Top Lady, you have to look at all the background, you see, and things that, you know, in his time, and then you find stuff that's really interesting there. And so we'll have a lot of stuff on Wesley and Whitfield, you see, and rivalries at that time as well, because that's so interesting. Does everyone have a handout? I've got a couple of spares here if you don't have a handout.
I thought he was a lady.
Top lady. He thought he was a lady. Top lady. Well, he's a top man, but he is a top lady as well. You'll see on the back of the handout you had this morning, last time I did a talk similar to this morning's, people were asking about limited atonement and various views about that. So I found this excellent chart out of Bruce Hindmarsh's biography of John Newton, which is on the back of this morning's handout, which will give you, I think it's called a taxonomy, an outline of various different positions on that particular subject. So do take that away and read that at your own leisure. There's something on the back of the handout for this afternoon as well. Don't read it during the talk. I'm watching you to make sure that you don't. Paul Darlington particularly. Right. Well, we're going to start by picking up the story from where I left off this morning, and we're going to look at the Reformed tradition after the Restoration. This morning we looked at the great persecution and the ejection of the Puritans from the Church of England. As Carl Truman has written, the great ejection of 1662 effectively removed from the church, and thus from the intellectual establishment, the vast majority of those ministers committed to a more thoroughly reformed faith. It therefore surrendered both the church and, as a result, the academy to a group whose theological concerns were generally more latitudinarian, liberal, you might say. Well, there were always theological problems within a dissenting community like that. And this one was no different. So those who were non-conformists at this period, some of them had a stress on the Bible alone to the exclusion of systematic and historical theology, which actually led a great many Presbyterian, Congregational and Baptist churches being fatally infected with Unitarianism in the century after the ejection. This was due in no small part, really, to the fact that ministers often rejected the very idea of subscribing to articles of faith. So things like Arianism, not the same as Arminianism from this morning, but Arianism and Socinianism, two heresies which basically relegate Christ from being of one being with the Father to just being a creature made by God. These were the popular heresies of the day. And this was linked, of course, with a rising interest in Enlightenment times, with testing everything by reason alone and caring very little for church history or historical theology. At several meetings of leading nonconformist divines in 1719 at Salter's Hall in London, dissenting ministers appeared to be split between subscribers and non-subscribers, those who were happy to sign some kind of Trinitarian confession of faith, and those who were opposed to doing such a thing on the basis that the Bible alone was their creed. Well, with that kind of debate going on, it's no surprise that within a century, most of these churches had turned Unitarian. That is, they only believed in one God, but not in three persons. Famously, even the church where Richard Baxter was once the minister in Kidderminster, it is now a Unitarian chapel. The dominance of the academy by these persecuting Anglicans and the linking of the idea of subscription with their despised prayer book and articles may be responsible for some of this doctrinal drift. Michael Watts, the leading historian of the dissenters, also claims that Arminianism played a leading role in softening up the theology of the dissenters, along with the middle way between Arminianism and Calvinism, what we call hypothetical universalism. They were also wary, too, of any attempt to impose religious beliefs on other people, even by way of an orthodox creed, because subscription was now seen by many to be a persecutor's tactic. So Reformed theology was not having an easy time of it in the nonconformist community. What about within the Church of England after 1662? Carl Truman said that the vast majority of those ministers committed to a more thoroughly reformed faith were rejected. But within the bounds of the C of E, many retained a great sympathy for Reformed theology, which would later prove to be a force for the church's renewal and revival. There was a Reformed minority of clergy working within the pale of the establishment, and it's well worth being aware of this very significant group of men. Now, a recent book by the Dean of Peterhouse, Dr. Stephen Hampton, has very helpfully dusted down this Anglican Reformed tradition for us. He calls the book Anti-Arminians, the Anglican Reformed Tradition from Charles II to George I. It's an excellent book, but before you write it down, it's £60. So I don't think we're all going to go out and buy a copy immediately. I'm reviewing it for Churchmen at some point, so you can look out for that if you're a subscriber to Churchmen. But it's an excellent piece of work. It's worth noticing that the Reformed here now means not anti-Catholic or anti-sacramentarian, but anti-Arminian, hence the name of the book. Now, of course, it's not that the conforming Calvinists were actually, you know, secretly Catholics or something like that, but they were generally more high church than those who were rejected. So they were much more committed to episcopacy in church government. They were committed to the suppression of dissent, and they liked high church stage props, things like robes and candles and elaborate church architecture and furnishings and all that jazz, which Paul Darlington will talk to us about tomorrow, I'm sure, knowing more about that than the rest of us. The names to conjure with here, and you may recognise some of these names, are John Edwards, not Jonathan Edwards, who's an American, but Dr. John Edwards of Cambridge, Thomas Barlow, who has a good claim to be the Vicar of Bray from that silly poem, Thomas Tully, John Hall, that's a good name, John Hall, Thomas Marshall, John Wallace, Robert South, William Beveridge, Edward Reynolds, you may recognise his name, Bishop of Norwich, John Pearson, who wrote a great book on the Creed, George Morley and Henry Compton. Now, some of these you may have heard of, many of them you won't. Stephen Hampton claims that there were about 12 bishops, 6 deans, and several of the senior divinity professors who had decidedly reformed credentials. Now, Hampton brings this group to our attention because evangelicals have all but forgotten about them. J.C. Ryle, for instance, tells us that before the evangelical revival of the 18th century, everything was natural theology, cold moral essays in the pulpit, and nothing of the weighty Reformation doctrines for which our martyred reformers had gone to the stake. And David Bebbington, in his classic work on evangelicalism in modern Britain, also claims that the doctrine of justification by faith had well nigh disappeared. Calvinism was at a discount after the Restoration. Now, some historians even speak of the overthrow of Calvinism after 1662, but that is not entirely accurate. See, these guys in this Reformed tradition didn't exactly like the term Calvinism. It had seedy foreign overtones. Weren't they all French? And it was linked in the public mind with regicide, killing the king, and with Presbyterianism. Yuck. But the label Reformed was much more happily embraced by these people, recognising that Calvin was only one of a number of significant voices in a much broader theological tradition. As Stephen Hampton says, after 1662, the Reformed may not have been in the majority, but they nevertheless remained a numerically and politically significant group within the Church of England. Now, it's good solid work, which is why he's going to be my supervisor for my PhD, because I think he's good, he knows his stuff. And he demonstrates very well the vitality and the strength of the Reformed cause, especially in Oxford and in Convocation, the sort of precursor to General Synod. The Reformed Anglicans were a force to be reckoned with, theologically and politically, even though they weren't the majority. Now, yes, there were also debates within that community as well over things like whether the active obedience of Christ was imputed to us or not. They debated that at length. Arminians also would deny that. But justification by faith alone was precious to these people, and they worked very hard to fortify a Reformed reading of the 39 Articles and the Prayer Book, especially on things like justification, the Trinity, and predestination. So the reformed dimension of the evangelical revival, which we're coming to, can no longer be read just as the rediscovery of an abandoned theological tradition, as some would have us believe. It was, rather, the re-energizing of a perfectly respectable, if minority, opinion within the 18th century church, which nicely explains why the majority of the conforming evangelicals during the 18th century revival were reformed Calvinists, because reformed theology still retained a significant hold on the loyalties of the Anglican clergy. Indeed, it's an absolutely essential part of what it means to be an Anglican. Now, that being said, something certainly different happened in the mid-18th century, something of huge importance for us. So we're going to look briefly now at the state of the church generally on the eve of the Great Awakening in from the 1730s onwards. But does anyone want to ask any questions so far? Itching to go for it. Go for it.
Where do you place William Gurnall in all of this? Because he conformed, and I would take to be a fairly conventional Calvinist, without any sort of twists attached. Mm. Do you have any comments on that?
Do I have any comments on William Gurnall, who conformed but seemed to be a pretty standard Calvinist? Yes, and there were many. I think I said before that there were some people who were able to conform.
Yes.
They may have been ejected originally, but they were able to conform later, or at the time in 1662, with a nod and a wink, if they did have some exceptions or scruples on certain matters. So I don't know much about him personally. He wrote that massive thing on the spiritual armour, didn't he? But I don't know much more than that. Definitely. He's not one of those mentioned by Stephen Hampton in that book, but he would bear some study, I think. Maybe you can tell me more about him later. Any other questions at that point? I'm happy for us. If you want to open a window or something as well, please feel free to do that, Steve. Yes, definitely. Late 17th century. Lots of those guys actually are late 17th century. Some go into the early part of the 18th century.
Are they all after William and Mary or anything?
Some of them live beyond William and Mary, yes, but not all. So Hampton's basically tracing the tradition of reformed evangelicals in the Church of England from after the Great Ejection to the beginning of the evangelical revival.
So that tradition was there between 1662 and 1688?
Yes. Yes, the tradition was definitely there. There were definitely some good guys around in the Church of England, but they were in a minority, definitely. See, we tend to think, well, we have tended to think until now, really, that all the good guys were kicked out. And that is massively true. A lot of good guys were, but there were also some people within the pale of the establishment who were able to stay with good theology. Angus.
Is there any cross-fertilisation between what was happening in Holland, the United Provinces, when William of Orange comes over? A lot of cross-fertilisation in other areas, whether it's finance or all sorts of things, but in theology at that critical time, which helped to preserve some of the Reformed heritage.
Were there any, I'll repeat the question, it's a good question, any things that were sort of cross-fertilisation coming over from the United Provinces, from the Netherlands, with William and Mary, other good things coming over at that time? Yes, there were. So one particular thing who's very important for Toplady is Herman Witsius, who's a Dutch theologian, who writes a big two-volume work you can get now called The Economy of the Covenants Between God and Man, which is good, you know, Calvinist Reformed covenant theology. And that is translated into English very early on. It's dedicated to William, King William, but it's translated into English and used in England extensively. So I'm fairly sure that Whitfield would have seen that, but I know Toplady did. It's as part of his complete works, there's a translation of part of it and that kind of thing. So good cross-fertilisation of the Calvinist strand of Dutch theology coming over into England. I think they probably brought some Arminian things with them too. But more of a good theological influx, as far as I know, as far as I can work out. Gosh, lots of questions. The non-jurors, yes, when were the non-jurors? They were a group of bishops and others who could not submit to William and Mary. They thought they'd usurped the throne from the rightful heir, James II, who had abandoned the country. So they objected to that. And so they're at the 1680s, 90s onwards.
Yeah, I mean,
theologically? Yes. Good question. I think more Arminian than Calvinist. But I don't know sufficient about them to be able to say that in any great detail. Sorry. Yes, they do claim they were rejected. That's right. Yes, I don't know. Got to admit when you don't know. There was a question over here.
I think William III was a very, very keen Calvinist.
Yes.
And that might have had an influence slightly after
the 1689. Yes, definitely. King William III himself was a keen Calvinist. Yes, correct. That's right. Very much. And brought all his Calvinist friends with him and others too. So, yeah, that's very good. Shall I plough on? The Great Awakening. There have been many good, solid reformed men and women in the church, but the church itself was not reformed or alive, it seems, in as a broad brush picture. William Hague, in his biography of William Wilberforce, which you may have seen, describes well the early 18th century church. In this biography, he speaks of the diluted nature of the Christianity that was preached in the church at this time, at the beginning of the 18th century, and the hypocritical and lackluster way in which Christianity was practiced. He describes the church as mired in a period of place-seeking, money-grabbing, and moral irrelevance. I'm talking about the 18th century here. I'm not talking about MPs at this very moment or the Church of England. But yes, you may say that. I couldn't possibly comment. When William Blackstone, who was a renowned lawyer at the time, did the rounds of all the best preachers in London, he concluded, "Not one of the sermons contained more Christianity than the writings of Cicero." After listening to sermons in York, Henry Venn similarly concluded that except for a single phrase or two, they might have been preached in a synagogue or a mosque without offence. Hague very amusingly actually highlights how a lazy clergy would steal sermons from each other so as to save themselves the effort and thought required to come up with something in their own words. I'm sure that kind of thing doesn't go on today, especially with the internet around and all those sermons on the internet that you can steal, apparently. Hard drinking, nepotistic, greedy socialites is how the clergy of this time are portrayed. There were, I'm sure, also many decent men labouring in the Lord's vineyard. But above all, writes William Hague, it was the ruthless competition for the most lucrative parishes and dioceses that made the 18th century church a place of touting and toadying ambition and caused considerable anger amongst a population whose tithe payments, remember, were funding the generous livings and evident abuses. But actually, people were angry about that, but apathetic about true religion. J.C. Ryle laments how such a state of things can have arisen in a land of free Bibles and professing Protestantism is almost past comprehension. So the earnestness and the sincerity and the passion of the men who formed Wesley's Holy Club in Oxford in 1729 was to be their greatest asset. If England was sound asleep, says J.C. Ryle, these were the men who would wake her up. George Whitfield was initially the most prominent of the preachers in the evangelical revival. Everywhere he went, he seemed to attract huge crowds, emotional crowds, with his dramatic style and his very plain speaking evangelism. There were many conversions, but also considerable controversy. Opponents of Whitfield attacked his enthusiasm, his critical and sometimes harsh tone towards others in the church, and his tactic of itinerant preaching. But his method and his manner were copied by others, and so his message of justification by faith alone also quickly spread. And after the strange warming of his heart in May 1738, John Wesley also joined the number of those who were passionately preaching the necessity of the new birth and salvation by grace alone. Now, that new emphasis was strange to many people, and Whitfield and Wesley put some people's noses out of joint by their forthright denunciation of existing denominations and churches and their lifeless ministries. Such an approach, of course, inevitably led to them not being invited to speak again in many pulpits. But their zeal was so strong that they took to the streets and the fields and they began open-air preaching, which on a day like this would be great, wouldn't it? In London, one open-air congregation was estimated at 50,000 people in the days before amplification. And even in the winter months of 1739, they could pull crowds of 10,000 people onto the cold streets of Bristol. On both sides of the Atlantic as well, there was great revival of interest in the gospel. And England seemed very different 50 years later. Religiously, the landscape changed after 50 years of these evangelists being around, dramatically. And morally, the temperature had risen substantially. In 1938, 200 years after Wesley's heart was warmed, somebody called John Wesley Breedy wrote a book cataloguing the changes that had occurred in English society over this period. And he called it, quite rightly, England Before and After Wesley. Because Wesley, although he wasn't the only one involved, of course, he and the other preachers who followed in his wake, like William Wilberforce, had a huge impact on our society and our church. Indeed, it's a common belief that since about the 19th century, that the evangelical awakening of the 18th century also contributed a great deal to saving England from that nasty revolution that had engulfed France. Vive les Methodists! That's what I say. But we're going to look now a bit at some of the revival rivalries. I mentioned that Wesley and Whitfield were early on barred from certain pulpits. One of those seems to have been my own church, St. Helens Bishopsgate. More than once I've been told the story of how graceless and dead St. Helens must have been in those days. Why? Because when John Wesley came to preach at St. Helens in May 1738, a Tuesday lunchtime, he wrote in his diary, he wrote in his diary that somebody there said to him, "Sir, you must preach here no more." Obviously, the doctrines of grace and salvation were despised and misunderstood in 18th century Bishopsgate. But I've been intrigued by that since I did a bit of research and I found that Wesley had actually preached at St. Helens in the March. This is about the May. He'd also preached in March without any sort of adverse reaction being reported. And then I read George Whitfield's journals and I found that he had preached at St. Helens as well in 1736. And he'd been received very, very favourably. So what could account for that? Well, I was less surprised at the strong reactions against Mr. Wesley when I tracked down the printed version of the sermon on Romans 8:32, which is the text that Wesley preached on at St. Helens in May 1738. It's in this volume of the works of John Wesley, which was republished very recently. From start to finish, this sermon that he preached is a sustained, emotive, combative, highly prejudiced and somewhat patronising rant against Reformed doctrine. He went on and on, I mean I underlined it on every page, on and on about how believing in predestination is bad for your health. It destroys any zeal you might have for good works, especially the good work of evangelism. Predestination, he says here, is a doctrine full of blasphemy. He complained bitterly against the horrible blasphemies contained in this horrible doctrine. And of course, as you might expect, limited atonement is, flatly contradictory to the whole tenor of the New Testament. Several proof texts follow, of course, without any explanation. It was just obvious, wasn't it, that no sane person could believe in that. To those who might disagree with Wesley's Arminian convictions, he says this: "You represent God as worse than the devil, more false, more cruel, more unjust. No scripture can prove predestination. I abhor the doctrine of predestination." I abhor it. That's strong, isn't it? He went on the next page, page 384, to compare those who believe in the Reformed doctrine of predestination and other things as worse than the baby-sacrificing worshippers of the false god Moloch. And, you know, this is not just an aside This is the whole sermon in that sort of tone. Well, I have to say I've slightly changed my views after doing a bit of historical research. I've changed my mind about where my own church stood in the 18th century. My sympathies are now very clearly with the discerning pastor or church warden who sought to protect St. Helens from hearing such divisive and melodramatic things again. I think if I'd been there, I too would have said, "Sir, you must preach here no more." Having read some of the sermons of Thomas Horton, who I mentioned earlier as one of the 17th century rectors of St. Helens, I can tell you that the Reformed doctrines of predestination and penal substitutionary atonement and particular atonement were all preached at St. Helens, and the imputation of the active obedience of Christ and irresistible grace and the importance of promiscuous gospel preaching for everybody and the necessity of the new birth, all very clearly preached in St. Helens and many other places, I'm sure, in the 17th century. Indeed, you only have to read one sermon of Thomas Horton, if you can get hold of it, on Romans 8 verse 1, to realise that he was a Reformed evangelical Anglican, even before the evangelical revival. So I think in that sort of context, it would be no surprise if Reformed doctrines were still held at St. Helens in the 18th century. And no surprise that Wesley's rant would fall on very unsympathetic ears. Julia Wedgwood wrote a 19th century biography of Wesley, and she makes this rather insightful comment that Wesley's sermon against predestination has in it something of that provoking glibness with which young or half-cultivated people settle in a few sentences questions that have exercised the deepest minds ever since the dawn of speculation. Indeed, it is evident on reading this sermon that of all the deep works that had been written on the subject, Wesley had never read one. And yet he pronounces so very forcefully on these weighty issues. And of course, that sermon was printed and reprinted and reprinted many times in the following years, despite howls of protest from George Whitfield and others who pleaded with Wesley not to publish it at all. It's not, as someone suggested to me recently, that Wesley just didn't understand grace until in early May 1738, because he didn't have his Aldersgate experience until later on in May 1738. No, that's not the case at all. He had fierce Arminian views, just like his mother, from very early on. And he printed this sermon time and time and time again, and several other polemical Arminian works. In fact, he published a dozen explicitly anti-Calvinist works, books and pamphlets and tracts, in just a few months after Whitfield gets back from his trip to America. Now that's a calculated move, isn't it? And that shows exactly where he stands. As Ian Murray says, this excellent little book, The Banner of Truth, have put out about Wesley. Ian Murray says, the truth is that Wesley's opposition to Calvinism stiffened rather than weakened. But you ask John Wesley about it, he says, well, God told me. God told me to preach this sermon and to print it. You see, he'd cast lots, thrown a dice, and received very clear guidance that he should preach and print against predestination. I think the truth, rather, is that it was all part of a rather sad and sordid power play against Whitfield, who had left Wesley to look after his nascent evangelical movement while he went abroad to preach to the pagan Americans. While he was gone, Wesley swoops in, uses his position, sort of entryism, you might say, to gather followers and to form his own movement. And his distinctive rallying calls were his stance against predestination, which Whitfield is in favour of. He stands against it very firmly. He abhors it. And also his teaching on perfectionism. Now, I don't know if you've seen Arnold Dallimore's excellent two-volume biography of Whitfield, but he tells the full story in there, in all its crude and its shocking detail, of how Wesley tried to stamp his own mark of authority on the revival and put himself at the head instead of Whitfield. Now, if you read that sermon in its entirety, you see that Whitfield had to feel constrained to reply to it in some way, which he did in a public letter that he wrote to Whitfield, to Wesley. It was a very, you can read that in Dalimore's biography and in the journals. It's a very clear and courteous and effective letter. What's more, Whitfield is very restrained and mild in comparison with Wesley's bitter invective, especially when you read that in the context of Wesley trying to, well, all his shenanigans in trying to hijack and take over Whitfield's movement while he's abroad. Whitfield refers to several books which he thinks would be helpful and unanswerable on the points in question. Clearly, Whitfield had read some deep works of theology on the subjects and encourages Wesley more than once to do the same. He even posted Wesley copies of the books to make sure that he got them. Not sure if he read them. Now, what's interesting, though, about all this is not just the personal story of the rivalry, but Whitfield's response to Wesley's bitter sermons places him very firmly in the Reformed tradition of the Church of England. Interestingly, at least one of the books that he recommends to Wesley was by one of those Reformed Anglicans that Stephen Hampton talks about, Dr. John Edwards. But he also recommends other mainstream Puritans like Matthew Henry to help correct Wesley's exegesis and understanding of the Bible. No mention of Calvin, interestingly. No mention of John Owen, although elsewhere he's very positive about John Owen. And Whitfield clearly held to limited atonement and was not a hypothetical universalist. Listen to this, for example, from one of Whitfield's sermons. He says this: "Blessed be God, our Lord knew those for whom he died. There was an eternal compact between the Father and the Son. A certain number were then given him as the purchase and reward of his obedience and death. For these he prayed, John 17, and not for the world. For these and these only he is now interceding, and with their salvation he will be fully satisfied." Now you can see when you just unpack that for a minute why Toplady calls Whitfield not only a great evangelist but also a most excellent systematic divine. Notice the covenant theology in here. The pactum salutis, the covenant of redemption between the Father and the Son in eternity, being the fountainhead from which all the waters of our salvation flow. And of course, in the rest of the reply as well, he shows several times why limited atonement, particular redemption, is a very good thing in terms of encouraging a godly life and spurring us on to evangelism, rather than being a bad thing on both counts, as Wesley had alleged. Predestination, rather than as something to be abhorred, was Whitfield's daily comfort and support, he said. Now that is warm piety allied to solid theology, all served up in a very warm and friendly tone. In one of his sermons, Whitfield talks about those who dislike Reformed theology. He doesn't name Wesley, but he certainly has him in mind. He says he wishes they had better heads, though he adds that many of them have good hearts, and prays that God would help us bear with one another where there is an honest heart. And you can see, I've put on the back of the handout for this afternoon, for this evening's talk, one or two pages from his sermons. You can buy the volume of sermons. It's published again by the Banana of Truth. Several sermons in this little volume. This is, one of them is photocopied on the back. And you can see there again, he discusses the pactum salutis, the covenant between the Father and the Son about our salvation and how important that is in Whitfield's theology. He was clearly and decidedly Reformed. But Wesley hated all that. Now, I know from a distance Wesley appears to be a great evangelical, doesn't he? We think of him that way. We're supposed to cheer when we hear Wesley, aren't we? One of our heroes. But, you know, sometimes we do just need to take off the soft focus lens and see some of the great ones of the past, warts and all. Frankly, the more I've read and learned about Wesley, the less I like him for his tone and his theology. I mentioned earlier that his grandfather, Samuel Annesley, was a nonconformist minister just off Bishopsgate. But Wesley's parents very quickly abandoned their Puritan roots, and Wesley called himself a high churchman, born of high churchmen. But he was brought up to despise the Calvinist heritage from his grandfather and the Puritan background he had. And he seems to have very little acquaintance with the theology of the Reformation. In terms of his theology then and his asceticism, his very rigorous, disciplined approach to things, he seems to have been more like, if I can put it this way, an Arminian fundamentalist rather than an Anglican evangelical. And let's face it, he was quite a self-important Arminian fundamentalist as well. Now, I don't want to be too rude about Wesley. He believed in all the objective facts of penal substitution, bodily resurrection. It'd be great if more people believed in those. And he was against antinomianism, which is a good thing to be against. You know, Richard Baxter says that whenever you're preaching, if you're a preacher, that you should also always put something in that's above the heads of your audience. Just, you know, so that they don't get above themselves. So I'm just throwing in some of these big words. If you want to ask me what they are later, do ask. He's against antinomianism. It's a good thing to be against. But he wasn't just mistaken about small things like predestination. He was also confused about Christian perfection, which he taught was attainable in this life. Perfection. And, you know, at times he even wobbled about the doctrine of justification as well. So as Ian Murray writes on page 97 of this book, if Wesley's theology was confused, why, some might ask, should we value his memory today? The answer lies not in his theology. That's not where his real legacy is. Christian leaders are raised up for different purposes. The 18th century evangelicals were primarily men of action. And in that role, John Wesley did and said much, which was to the lasting benefit of many thousands. Now, Whitfield, on the other hand, though he was rather prone to some dramatic excesses himself in the early years, is a much more admirable figure, I think. His reformed theology gave his message and his preaching a depth and a stability which Wesley lacked. And while Wesley's influence would spread far and wide across the globe, so that even today at conference centres like Hylee, there are Methodists meeting in another room just over there, Whitfield's lasting legacy has remained within the Church of England largely, and the evangelical movement and party within the church. As I mentioned earlier, most of those conforming evangelicals and those in the Countess of Huntingdon's connection as well were reformed, like Whitfield. The main exception being J. Fletcher of Madeley, but then you usually get an eccentric or two called Fletcher in every generation. Let the reader understand. I have said that to Jonathan, so don't worry. Now, to illustrate all this, there's one man within Whitfield's circle that we should give a little bit more attention to, and that is Augustus Montagu Toplady. Because he's a very good example of that fabulous species, a reformed evangelical Anglican. But before we look at Toplady, why don't I pause again and see if there are any questions? Why don't we just stand up for a minute? Do you want a bit of air and a bit of get the lungs going a bit? Come on, hands in, everyone put your hands in the air. It's what Dick Lucas used to make us do this at Cornhill. We've got a great picture of him with his hands in the air. Dick Lucas teaching us at Cornhill how to go charismatic. Touch your toes if you can see your toes. Touch the wall. Have a deep breath. Now, you can stand up and ask your question. Does anyone have any questions after the...
Yeah, just ask you about...
one there and then one there.
...opposition to antinomianism, which is to be opposed to.
Yes.
But wasn't that the word that the Arminians actually used to describe Calvinists?
You're asking about the opposition of Wesley to antinomianism.
Yes.
Yes, well, that's right. And antinomianism is often the thing that Arminians throw at Calvinists and say, you're an antinomian because you don't believe in good works. You're against the law, antinomos, which is law in Greek. Yeah, that's right. I think that's right. He often, his opposition to antinomianism is really just a veiled form of anti-Calvinism. Yeah. You'd not be wrong in saying that. Now, there's one at the back. Yes, brother.
I was just going to say,
what it is.
What it is.
And also what? How to spell it?
Who can spell it?
Who can spell it? Antinomies, it's being against the law. It's the idea that there is no law for Christians. You can live however you want. Which, of course, the Arminians would say that is what we think, because we're all about free grace, and it doesn't matter about your works, don't contribute to your salvation, then why should I do anything? You're against the law, which, of course, is what they said to Paul as well, isn't it? In Romans, he addresses that calumny. Brother, yes, you're going to first... Yes, sorry about that. Against law. Nomos is the Greek word for law, so it's being against the law, God's law, and not wanting to obey that, or thinking that you don't have to obey that. There's one here first. Yes, David's.
Hyper-Calvinism, which in actual fact was very rampant in some Baptist circles.
Yes.
Guild, for example.
Yes. Yes.
And that high Calvinism, sort of predestination, in fact, you don't even offer the gospel freely.
Yes. So the question is more about hyper-Calvinism, yes, and then the word hyper-Calvinism around, which was much more strict. Hard to summarise your question, which was so very well put. But yes, there were real antinomians around, so people who really were against law. In fact, people in the Westminster Assembly had very much opposed a real antinomianism that was around. People saying, I'm saved, so that's fine, doesn't matter what I do now. So you do have to oppose that. But there was also a hyper-Calvinism which went too far into saying things like, well, you'll see this on the taxonomy about limited atonement on the other handout. There are some people who say you shouldn't even promiscuously tell everyone the gospel, because not everyone is saved, so you can't tell everyone the gospel. Which is silly, by the way, just in case anyone's going to ask me, but that's silly. The rhyme, David.
Saved from the law, what a wonderful condition. I can sin as I like and still get remission, which is sort of a summary.
Yes, and it's silly. That's right. John Gill would be one of those who is tending towards that. Most definitely. The Baptist pastor of what became the Metropolitan Tabernacle. BJ first. Oh, Anthony.
Event when Wesley's heart was strangely warmed. I spoke to Mike Ovey about this, and I said, well, it sounds to me as though not so much he was converted, but that he was gaining assurance.
Mm-hmm.
Because what he says suggests to me is somebody who's getting assurance.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Ovey said, well, bear in mind that Wesley, as an Arminian, will probably confuse assurance and
yes,
gaining salvation anyway.
Yes. Yes, so the comments about Wesley's Aldersgate experience, the 24th of May, 1738. Is he really being converted then, or is it just an experience of assurance? I felt I did trust in Christ for my salvation, is what he says. It sounds like assurance, yeah. And very at that stage, I think that's right. Who could disagree with Mike Ovey, who told you that? I mean, I'm not, I wouldn't dare.
I
tend never to disagree with Ovi One Kenobi if I can avoid it. But that's right. That's right. An Arminian at that stage would probably confuse assurance with salvation. So I think Wesley probably was saved before that. But that was a very significant time for him. And I mean, that's the same with many of us. I think I was converted when I was 10. But that I definitely had a greater experience of God's grace and call and grabbing hold of me when I was 19. And I thought for a long time that was my conversion, but I don't think it was in retrospect.
I think often appreciate, I don't say understanding election, because I don't think you can understand election, but I think appreciating the doctrine of election has a lot to do with assurance.
Yes.
Because you're more likely to get assurance if you're Calvinist than if you're an Arminian.
You're more likely to get assurance if you're Calvinist than if you're an Arminian. Yes.
When God was just sitting on the sidelines watching me.
Preach it, brother. You're doing well for me. That sounds great. VJ, did you have a question? And then one more, I think.
Oh, Wesley came out of the Church of England.
Is it true that Wesley came out of the Church of England? Am I going to go on to that?
You were like, you started a
yes.
Methodist movement.
Yes, there's a Methodist movement now, that's right. He would say that he was always trying to be a true Anglican and never renounced his Anglican orders and wasn't ordained Anglican. But clearly, he spun off into a different direction, started ordaining his own people, and started his own movement, which is now a separate denomination.
Is it because of this that, with all humility, Methodists are more work-centred than...
Does this what I'm saying, have an impact on Methodism today? Absolutely, yes. Methodism at its heart is the Arminian version of what happened in the Revival, whereas the Evangelical Party within the Church of England is really the true inheritor of Whitfield's legacy from this time. So, yeah, Methodism generally in this country is Arminian. Of course, there are some good... Where are the Welsh Calvinists? The Welsh Calvinistic Methodism is much different and owes more to Whitfield and others in his circle.
You're always learning.
Oh, it's brilliant, isn't it? We've got time for one more question. I think there was one over here. Did somebody want... No? No, brother. Sorry, I'm not trying to... Am I getting on to supralapsarianism? No, I'm not. And I deliberately didn't mention it, but, you know, if you want to have a chat about supralapsarianism and infralapsarianism, then you can go and ask David Streeter. Because he brought it up. We could talk about that, but I don't think it's the most profitable way to spend the next half an hour. Number four, Augustus Montague Toplady. Toplady was born in 1740, and he died in 1778, which means, if you just think about it, he was 38 when he died, which is very young, and he lived his very short life right in the middle of the evangelical awakening. As he was born, Whitfield and Wesley were falling out. All that was happening, and Augustus Montague Toplady was born. He outlived Whitfield by 8 years, but Wesley outlived both of them and continued having an impact until his death in 1791. At the age of 15, Toplady, the top man, was converted after listening to one of Wesley's followers preaching in a barn. He confesses to having been somewhat confused in his early years as a Christian, having adopted the Arminianism of the preacher through whom he came to believe, naturally. But as an undergraduate at Trinity College Dublin at the age of 18, obviously not quite convinced by what he had been taught, he read the sermons of Thomas Manton, a Puritan, on John chapter 17. And then he read a systematic theology by an Italian theologian, Jerome Zanchius. After this, in Latin, by the way, after this he became a thoroughly convinced Calvinist. I do wish we could persuade more teenagers to read such good material. Toplady is, of course, best known as a hymn writer. Rock of Ages, Debtor to Mercy Alone. What was the one you sang the other day? Sovereign Protector I Have. Marvellous, brilliant songs. We probably sing them from time to time in our churches. But in his day, Toplady had an equally strong reputation, perhaps even stronger, as a reformed controversialist rather than just a hymn writer. Here's why. In 1769, Oxford University, which you'll remember required subscription to the 39 Articles from its students, expelled 6 evangelical undergraduates for having Methodist tendencies. Calvinist Methodist tendencies. Toplady then entered the lists on their behalf with a stinging rebuke to the professor of modern history, Thomas Knowle, who had written against the students for holding views inconsistent with the doctrine of the Church of England. Toplady's book was called The Church of England Vindicated from the Charge of Arminianism. And here he goes on full frontal assault against Anglican Arminians when he writes this. If Arian subscription, Arians being those who deny the divinity of Christ, if Arian subscription to Trinitarian articles is palpably dishonest, then by all the rules of argument in the world, Arminian subscription to articles that are Calvinist must and can be no less criminal. That same year, urged on by the Reformed Baptist pastor John Gill, who was a friend of his, Toplady published his own translation of that book by Zanchius, which had helped persuade him to become a Calvinist. He called his translation The Doctrine of Absolute Predestination Stated and Asserted. Marvellous book titles. At this stage, the much older John Wesley comes back into the story, because he obviously was not a great fan of Zanchius. But rather than publish a refutation of Zanchi, he published an amended, abridged, and enlarged version of Toplady's translation. That's a bit odd, isn't it? Why is Wesley publishing a version of a translation of a Calvinist writer? Well, what he did was, he missed out all the Bible verses and all the Bible reasoning, skipped out all the argument, much of the argumentation, and tried to summarise the book in his own words. And at the end, he added a paragraph all of his own. The sum of all is this. 1 in 20 of mankind are elect. 19 out of 20 are reprobated. The elect shall be saved, do what they will. The reprobate will be damned, do what they can. Reader, you must believe this or be damned. Witness my hand, Augustus Toplady. This was a calumny, an outrageous and false summary of what Zanchi and Toplady believed. Now, Toplady, as you can imagine, was mortified and offended by this rather cavalier attitude to publishing. Wesley had mutilated his book, changed its tone and its emphasis completely, added that little scurrilous ending to paint Calvinism in as bad a light as possible, and then attributed it all to Toplady. Put it out under his name. And I told you I like this man less and less the more I've discovered about him. And it's no wonder, is it, that there was tract warfare between Wesley and Toplady for some time after this. So it's very clear that Toplady was a thoroughly reformed theologian. And where's his book? Here it is. Here are the complete works of Augustus Toplady. You're looking at it thinking, oh, it can't be very much. It's only one volume. But you open it up and it's double columns and very small print. And it's 1,000 pages or so. So there's quite a lot of it here. And I read this through. He's quite familiar with a range of European reformed thinkers and writers, including Zanchius, Witsius, who I mentioned before, the Dutch theologian, Turretin, Bullinger, and James Usher. Now, they seem to have influenced him much more than John Calvin himself, whose name Toplady's happy to be associated with, but whose Presbyterianism on the issue of church polity and government he very firmly disagrees with. He accepts the label Calvinist, but it's very clear reading Toplady that Calvin isn't his great hero or idol. I think the person you hear most often quoted in Toplady is Fox from Fox's Book of Martyrs. So Toplady is a reformed theologian. But he's also very clearly an evangelical in any sense of the word. Indeed, he was an evangelical preacher of some power and persuasion who was greatly used by God in his time as a vicar of Broadhembury, that well-known place in the middle of nowhere, and some other small villages in the West Country. Sorry, there's no one from Broadhembury here, is there? Okay, good. He was a very active evangelist, and he preached for conversion very powerfully. And his ministry, like his hymns, was firmly Christ-centred and not all about controversy all the time. He was closely acquainted with all the other leading evangelicals, such as William Romaine, John Berridge, George Whitfield, and Her Ladyship, the Countess of Huntingdon. So on all the standard definitions, Toplady is an evangelical. But he didn't think of himself as an evangelical. That's not his designation of choice. He thought of himself as a reformed Anglican. Now, I mentioned before that classic work David Bebbington put out on evangelicalism. He doesn't dwell, as I've done, on the seriousness of this Calvinist-Arminian divide. Why doesn't he do that? Well, because he wants to make evangelicalism as a movement a novel Enlightenment development united by four isms that he's made up: conversionism, activism, biblicism, and crucicentrism. In other words, the cross, yes. He thinks that evangelicals are those in the 18th century who focused on conversion, who got on with stuff, activism. They were Bible people and they were cross people. They focused on the cross. So Wesley and Whitfield can be lumped together with Toplady and others into one movement if you use all those things, because they're all of those things. But Bebbington doesn't look at all, really, at the Calvinist-Arminian rift, or doesn't think it's important. And yet, as Paul Helm says, the participants in the Calvinist-Arminian controversy certainly did not think that what united them was greater than what divided them. The occurrence of the Calvinist-Arminian division was very serious, fairly permanent, and sad. The fact that Toplady then thought of himself as part of the Anglican Reformed tradition and not, first and foremost, as an Anglican evangelical is vitally important. This self-understanding can be seen most clearly, I think, in his longest and most detailed work. It's called The Historic Proof of the Doctrinal Calvinism of the Church of England. Now, you've got to let him off for his titles. It's not as long as a Puritan title for books, but it's called The Historic Proof of the Doctrinal Calvinism of the Church of England. It takes up quite a hefty part of this volume. So it's a 700 pages long in a normal book. Quite a big thing, two volumes. And the point of this work, which I hope we might reprint at some point, J.C. Ryle says it's unanswered and unanswerable. And the point is to establish that Anglicanism, in its purest and most authentic expression, is reformed. As he says at the beginning of the work, our pulpits may declare for free will, but the desk, the prayers, and the whole of our standard writings as a church breathe only the doctrines of grace. Calvinism. He goes about proving that hypothesis, not by examining the articles and the prayer book and the homilies. And that's what I expected, actually, when I picked up the work. I thought he's going to look at the articles. He's going to expound how the articles are Calvinist, how the prayer book expresses that in theology, and then with some quotes from the homilies and things like that. But that's not what he does here. He does do that elsewhere in his complete works, but not in this major work. What he does here is it's not a textual proof, but a doctrinal proof. It's a historical book. So he opens up his history books, as we've been doing, and he attempts to show what all the leading theologians taught on certain issues over the past 200 years or so. What issues does he pick? Well, he reads through his church history and he demonstrates quite forcefully and convincingly that on election, justification, limited atonement, free will, original sin, perseverance of the saints, assurance and perfectionism, that anybody who's anybody in the history of the Church of England is doctrinally a Calvinist and definitely not an Arminian or a Pelagian crypto-papist, as he prefers to call them. So basically what he does is he gives us a historical overview of what the fathers, the reformers and other key people taught about Tulip and on other two areas as well. The things that Wesley had particularly distinguished himself over. He goes through and he shows what the Anglican tradition is on justification and perfectionism. And it is quite devastating as a collection of evidence, I have to say. He's not the first or the last Reformed Anglican to attempt to demonstrate the reformed nature of the Church of England. People have been doing that against the Arminians since the start of the 17th century, when people fought over whether the 5 points of the Synod of Dort were acceptable things for Anglicans to believe. He may not have been the only one to be doing that, but he's definitely the most thorough. There is 700 pages of this stuff. Now, whether he's always fair in handling his sources, we must leave for another time, but generally he is. He admits when the evidence doesn't quite seem as compelling as he'd like it to be, and he points out some places where Anglicans of the past have been, well, they've gone too far in opposing Arminianism or Pelagianism, and they've slipped into doctrines which even he thinks are too strict, too high, like hyper-Calvinism, as David mentioned. A case could be made, I think, that he's not very sophisticated when it comes for the evidence for people's views on definite atonement. He's definitely a believer there, and some of his hymns show that very clearly. As he says of Christ in one hymn, all the sins of God's elect were made to meet on thee. See, for top lady, Christ died for the church, his bride, his sheep. But occasionally his evidence is a little bit too strained and requires significant unpacking to make it say what he wants it to say. And he doesn't seem all that aware of the respectable history of Calvinist hypothetical universalists in Britain. People I like to call chubs. Calvinist hypothetical universalists in Britain. Chubs. That's better than Amaraldian, because that's French. So we don't want to call them Amaraldian, that's all French. So Calvinist hypothetical universalists in Britain, the chubs. Toplady doesn't seem aware of those people. He doesn't really go into the nuances on that point, because they're not part of his purpose. He just wants to show that unlimited atonement, the Arminian position, is not Anglican. I say that because, can I say this at a church society conference? A few years ago, I went to a reform conference. I went to a reform conference, and we heard there repeatedly from one speaker that the Church of England is definitely against limited atonement. Well, Top Lady's evidence from history convinces me that it cannot be that clear-cut. Whatever you make of some of the disputed articles like Article 31 or the comfortable words in the communion service. If so many of our leading reformers and theologians believed in efficacious, effective, personal, definite atonement, it would be a surprise to find the formularies that they came up with enshrining something completely different, wouldn't it? It would also be a shame, I think, to jettison most of the men in J.C. Ryle's book, The Christian Leaders of the 18th Century. You may have seen that. We can't jettison all of them as un-Anglican. Well, most of them believed in limited atonement. They're not un-Anglican. And, of course, John Newton as well believed in limited atonement, as did a host of other evangelical evangelists, like the Baptist Charles Spurgeon. A top lady's evidence on the other points at issue in the Arminian controversy is so overwhelming and clear that I think J.C. Ryle is right to say that it's unanswerable, really. The Church of England, as anyone looking dispassionately at Article 17 can see, is in its foundational documents a Reformed and Calvinist church. And that's why Top Lady calls it the best of visible churches. So to conclude that section then, Top Lady is a Reformed Evangelical Anglican. All three words are important in describing him in some way, and I'm going to resist the temptation to rank them or relate them in order of importance, which is why I think on the handout there's a comma between each one. So he is all three. Does anyone have any questions? Before I move on to a conclusion at the end, questions, VJ?
Pardon my ignorance. Can you unpack limited atonement?
Do you have your you want me to unpack limited atonement? Do you have your handout from the first session this morning?
Yes.
If you look at the handout from the first session this morning, there's a whole outline there of the different views that people take on the extent of the atonement. The question is, what was Jesus intending when he came to earth? Did he intend to save a certain number of people that the Father had sent him to save? If so, he died for them and they will be saved. Or did he intend to save everybody, but he doesn't quite achieve that because some people resist his will and don't want him to save them? Did he come to make everybody savable, to make it possible for everyone to be saved, the Arminian view? Or did he come to save them, to actually effectively, efficaciously, definitely save them? That's the Calvinist view. So it's about the intent of the atonement as much as the extent of it. Everyone, as I said, limits the atonement in some way. So a Calvinist limits it in terms of the number of people it's effective for. It's effective for those that the Father has given to Christ. Whereas an Arminian limits the atonement in its effectiveness. They say, oh, the cross doesn't actually save anybody. It just makes it possible for them to be saved if they want to be.
Are you taking the sovereignty of God from that then?
Yes. That's right. You would be, the Arminian view is very much downplaying the sovereignty of God.
Because you see, I know what happened to me from the time I was born, but God knows it from the beginning.
Mm.
So God can elect and at the same time give me freedom to choose.
Yes, that's right. God can do elect you, and also you think from your perspective in the history that you've chosen. In terms of election, the Arminian would say, Ephesians 1 and other places, Romans 9 would say, God, from before the foundation of the world, chose a certain number of people, a definite number of people, and then he sent in Christ, the Son, agreed that the Son would come to save them. This is what Whitfield's saying in that quote on the back of the handout for now. He sent the Son to save those people, and they will be saved. Nothing can snatch them from his hand. No power of hell, no scheme of man can ever pluck them from his hand. Whereas an Arminian would say, God, before the beginning of time, looked forward, and he saw who was going to choose him out of their own free will, and let's call them elect. So it's a slightly different. You're elected not on the basis of God just wants you, but freely. God is sovereign, but an Arminian says you're elect on the basis that God sees you're going to have faith.
Yeah,